Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I am really interested today to be interviewing Sally Hayden, a journalist who's written a really fascinating and quite detailed new book titled My Fourth Time We Drowned, published by Melville House Press in 2022, that details the stories of the migrant crisis, focusing on North Africa, especially Libya, that examines kind of all different stages of what happens to migrants who are attempting to cross the Mediterranean and get to Europe, both from Libya and from other parts of Africa, detailing their stories, both kind of the good and the bad, in this really quite intense book, but in a lot of ways shows us quite successfully both the individual stories of particular people and speaks to the wider crisis and the politics that are involved. So it's quite an accomplished book to cover all these different things. And so I'm really pleased to welcome Sally Hayden to the podcast to discuss it.
Thank you so much for having me.
So could you please start off by introducing yourself and your background?
Yeah, sure. So like you said, my name is Sally Hayden. I'm an Irish journalist. I've been a journalist around nearly a decade now, like maybe 9 years, and I've been reporting on migration issues probably since 2014, 2015, the year of the so-called European migrant crisis, and I've been freelance since 2016. So this book is the work of years of reporting, really, and at the moment I'm working also as the Africa correspondent for the Irish Times newspaper, but I work for like a lot of other places as well. I've worked for the Washington Post, New York Times, Newsweek, Time Magazine, BBC, like pretty much everywhere that you can imagine.
Well, and as you sort of, as that hints at, you've worked at a lot of places and you've covered this issue in a lot of ways. This has been something you've spent a lot of time on with exposés on TV and written journalism and social media and all sorts of ways you've engaged in this topic and reported on this topic. So what drove you to write a book on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, this, like, I didn't set out to report on migration. I had a staff job 2014 to 2016, and that was the year that you know, refugees arriving in Europe and migrants arriving in Europe were making a lot of headlines. And so I started reporting then for Vice News, where I was working, just meeting refugees and trying to figure out what was going on. And of course, I then realized, you know, this is a lot more complex than it was being painted by politicians at that time or in the media, that actually people were coming from a huge number of different countries for a huge number of different reasons. But I started just meeting people and basically ended up getting tips that led to a series of different investigations. And what became kind of clear, what's interested me about this all along, is the things that aren't understood by the general public, like the parts of what is happening that actually challenge what our preconceptions might be. But I mean, the reporting has kind of happened still a bit by chance, because I started being contacted a lot by people in different countries who were looking for help or assistance and wanted me to report on various aspects of what was happening. And one of those messages came in August 2018 from a refugee who was locked up in a Libyan migrant detention center with 500 others, who basically said that they had pretty much all tried to cross the Mediterranean Sea to reach Europe and been forcibly returned and locked up indefinitely without legal recourse in a detention center. Yeah, sorry, this is a long answer, but basically that message came out of nowhere. What happened in the aftermath was that my name, my number began to be passed around different detention centers, where people had hidden phones. So it was like refugees were locked up with, you know, locked up indefinitely, but there were hidden phones inside, and they basically started sending me evidence of what they were going through. And this was effectively a result of hardening European migration policy that had forced them away from Europe's borders. And the book came about, I mean, I didn't even set out to write a book, but I started gathering this information about a year in. Someone asked me, would I try and write a book? And I initially thought that I didn't want to, and then I thought, actually, I'm gathering so much information of a situation that is not being properly documented, and in my opinion, you know, Europeans were complicit in this. Like, this was being done in our name, and yet people weren't aware of it. And so I wanted to make sure that there was a proper documentation of this. And so around 2019, I started looking at whether I could write a book. 2020, I got the book deal, and then the result is what's just been published in March, My Fourth Time We Drowned. And yeah, it was kind of a long process. So it was basically an attempt to make sure that this is all actually being documented, and also an awareness that these were testimonies and voices coming from people who had been silenced, or, you know, who were quite deliberately being silenced. And I wanted to make sure that evidence and that information was available.
Thank you for explaining that. I think it gives us a really great foundation for kind of unpacking some of the testimonies and stories that you record in the book. And to kind of frame that, can you explain some of the ways and reasons that lead to refugees ending up in Libyan detention centres?
Yeah, so it's basically, you know, there's many different migration routes, and we use the term migrants and refugees. I mean, this is, like I said, people coming from a huge number of different countries, fleeing a huge number of different situations. But Libya has kind of been like a jumping off point for people trying to get to Europe, particularly people from across Africa. So, as I'm sure a lot of people know, since 2011, there hasn't been a functional government in Libya. That was when Gaddafi was ousted. And so in the aftermath of that, there's a variety of like problems across Africa, including like dictatorship in Eritrea, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, you know, war in South Sudan. And people who were fleeing these different situations kind of met together in Libya with others who were fleeing, you know, extreme poverty in parts of West Africa, and other situations there in terms of insecurity. And Libya has been a place where people take to the sea and try and reach either Italy or Malta. And that's why Europe, basically the European Union, in the aftermath of the migrant crisis in 2015, there were kind of far-right politicians and groups were utilizing that to try and seize power. And one of the responses was that more centrist or left-wing even politicians in Europe were trying to make attempts to stop migration, basically to stop this from being used as a tool to, you know, to turn the continent more far right, I guess. And you know, we hear now the, you know, the so-called migrant crisis, that it's effectively over, or at least before Ukraine, that's what European politicians were saying, but actually what they were doing was just fortifying the borders, making sure that people couldn't actually get onto European territory. And so that's been happening. There was a deal done with the EU and Turkey. So that was done in the Eastern Mediterranean to stop people from crossing there. But then the more difficult thing for them was that because Libya isn't a functional state, they had to come up with a way to try and stop people from crossing from Libya. So one of the answers that was found was to equip and train the Libyan Coast Guard, which is also kind of a looser collection of, you know, of people than you would imagine. But if you have someone fleeing, basically under international law, it's illegal for European ships to return refugees or migrants to Libya because their lives are in danger there. But it's legal if a Libyan vessel does the interception and return. So what was happening was that the EU was carrying out surveillance, and still is happening. The EU carries out surveillance, flying helicopters, planes, drones above the central Mediterranean to spot refugee boats now. And then the Libyan Coast Guard is the one that actually does the interception. So since 2017, more than 90,000 men, women, and children have been intercepted like this. And what happens to them when they return to Libya is they're locked up indefinitely in detention centers that have been compared to concentration camps by Pope Francis, among others. And they don't have any legal recourse there. They don't have a lawyer. You know, they can't appeal. They're not even charged, so they can't appeal the charges. And that's basically just become a system that's forcing people kind of out of sight, out of mind, you know. And the EU doesn't carry out proper analysis in terms of the consequences of this, in terms of what happens to people who are returned to Libya. And I know this because I've interviewed spokespeople for the EU border agency who say that it's not their responsibility once the refugees are intercepted or rescued, as they would say. It's not their responsibility to figure out, for example, how many people die when they're returned to detention centers or what happens to them in the aftermath. And so it's kind of, that's how they end up in detention, basically. That's a very, another long way of explaining.
See the whole context.
Yeah, that's how they end up in the detention center. So this is, since the vast majority anyway seem to have ended up in detention centers, and these are centers that are officially aligned with the UN-backed government in Tripoli, but actually are being run by militias. And so there isn't even proper oversight of what's happening in each one.
So how then do the refugees in these detention centers communicate, particularly abroad?
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the very strange things for me when I started reporting on this. And this, I think, is why this type of reporting couldn't have happened, you know, until quite recently, because obviously now we have smartphones are permeating a lot more of our world, and people will, like, one of the things I think, if you just read about, you know, migration issues, you don't understand that the SIM card is, you know, the lifeline. It's the way that somebody can call for help. It's the way that they can get information, which is really like the most precious thing to people who are in a detention situation or even people making a dangerous journey. And so what I realized was in these detention centers, phones are prohibited, but detainees will do everything they can to either make sure that they keep a phone on them or that they can access a phone in some way, or even that they keep a SIM card on them so that if they come across a phone, they can use it. And so quickly it became clear that there were phones in these detention centers that were, you know, very well hidden. And So I got that first message in August 2018. I started reporting on this. You know, I did all the verification, like asking for everything, GPS location, selfies, you know, contact details for families, because I was very skeptical as well. How is there a phone in this detention center? You know, how are they getting data? Even how are they getting electricity? And it became clear that there were phones inside the detention centers, and my contact details were being passed around, a lot of them, after a few weeks, and that this information was really hadn't been getting out in the same way. And I just started gathering it, like, and the sources, I mean, they were in huge danger. Like, people were really going to huge lengths. You know, they would tell me, like, I'm not messaging my family. I don't have enough data to talk to my family and to you. So I'll just talk to you because I want you to know this information. Or, you know, people would, they turn on the phone at night. So messages would suddenly, you know, all day it might be quiet, and then around 11 p.m. suddenly I'd start getting messages from many different detention centers from people saying, here's what happened today, you know, here's a photo, here's a video, here's evidence, anything that they could send to make me understand. Or also calling for help, you know, this person needs medical care, this, you know, we haven't eaten in 2 days, we haven't got water, we need this, there's a child with this illness, you know. And so that was the lifeline. But there were detention centers where either I wasn't in touch with people, or potentially there weren't even phones, because I know that in times, for example, actually strangely, when there was conflict in Tripoli, it would be easier to communicate with people in the detention centers because there was less oversight, because the detention centers were militia run, so the militias could be distracted, you know, by the war, basically. But when there was not conflict, that was when things would get very strict and it would become hard to communicate with people. And some people I did lose contact with for weeks. And some people, you know, I actually have lost contact with completely. So, it was dangerous.
And in addition to being dangerous and difficult for the refugees, that's also, on your end, there are a lot of challenges associated with receiving these streams of information. How did you deal with the kind of practical challenges as well as the ethical challenges of getting all this very personal, very sensitive information and reporting on it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to give you a better actually answer for your first question, that was largely why I wrote a book, because there was a lot that I couldn't publish at the time. And that was for, you know, safety reasons, largely, that I couldn't identify sources, that, you know, I had to strip anything that might identify them. But also I was aware if I published something, there could be a search of that, you know, and this did happen. Like my sources would ask me, please publish a report on this, like, please publish it. But then the next day there would be a search and everybody would be searched for phones, and some phones would be confiscated. And of course, you have to question, is that worth it? And I don't know that there's a perfect answer to that. So I would discuss the consequences with my sources. And generally first, actually, a lot of my job became passing information from them to humanitarian organizations or to the UN. So I wasn't publishing a huge amount of what I was receiving. I was passing that on between, you know, different organizations that we were hoping that might be able to help them. And generally, when I published something, it would be because those attempts had failed. And something had, you know, or if there was an emergency, like a very serious emergency situation. I don't know that there's a perfect answer, except that practically it became that I set my WhatsApp, actually was set to download everything that I was sent. So, for example, people would take videos to try and prove. There was one guy who was brought to, this was quite regular, but people were being kind of like forced to assist the military, the militias, during the conflict. And so they'd be brought to areas where like huge amounts of weapons were being stored, and they'd have to, you know, lift those weapons and wash military vehicles. You know, in some cases they were offered the chance to fight, or they were told, you know, if you fight, we'll give you extra food, things like that. And so they would take videos to prove this, but I couldn't publish those at the time because it was too dangerous. But they wanted that evidence to exist for the future. So my phone was set to automatically download everything that I was sent. But then, of course, I began to get very frightened, you know, if I didn't have internet, if I had to go on a flight, for example, or even if I was underground, because I was living in London for the first part of this reporting. Like, and I didn't have an internet connection, that was concerning. So yeah, it was a very intense time. It's a challenging time. I don't know how many people have faced this sort of situation specifically, but you're anxious all the time. You don't want any danger to come to the people that you're in communication with. But at the same stage, if they're telling you, you know, we're in a life or death situation now, and if you publish something that could help us, so we want you to publish something, then I do think that they also have, you know, it would be unfair of me to say I'm the only one who can evaluate the risk. I think that they have the best idea of what the risk is.
So moving to discuss kind of one of the aspects of life for these people in the detention centers that you discuss in the book that I think is really quite illuminating on a number of levels, because it draws together what you've been talking about of kind of risk assessment. It also sort of links up the personal life and the impact of policies, as you've already discussed. And that's kind of how being put in these detention centers, how that influences plans and agency around love and marriage, particularly for the refugees caught up in these detention centers. And this is perhaps an area that we don't necessarily think about, right? We think about kind of the danger of it and the getting into the boats and worrying about communication or drowning or food or violence and all these other things. And yet you show really clearly with some of the testimonies and evidence in the book that it actually being in these detention centers impacts a much wider array of kind of life circumstances in a lot of ways. So I was wondering if you could kind of give us a bit of an insight into how these people you've been speaking to, how they negotiated and thought about love and marriage in the immediate term and also kind of long term, given these very dangerous circumstances.
Yeah, sure. So with writing the book, I mean, I wanted to make sure that you could see the humanity of people. You know, I didn't want it to just be a big list of kind of human rights abuses, because I think that when we, you know, the whole way that these systems and structures are set up, it's all about dehumanizing, isn't it? And for me, I also felt like I was contributing to that, because when I did reports, I had to strip so much identifying information, like all of the identifying information, that it became that, you know, you were being so vague that people couldn't imagine a real person being going through these experiences or being behind it. And one of the things that I was interested in, I mean, I'm always interested in this, but it's like personal relationships and how people deal with a detention situation or how they deal with any sort of situation in terms of their personal relationships. And this was something that started to come up because this book is based on like years of communication with people, and a lot of that would just be, you know, general chatting. It wouldn't be, you know, tell me about this terrible thing or that terrible thing. It would just be, you know, at that point you have somebody who hasn't seen sunlight for a year maybe, but they have nothing to do, and they're like looking for someone to talk to as well. So yeah, the journeys, I think people don't understand as well, these migration journeys, a lot of the time seeking safety, it takes years and years. So you kind of lose, and you've kind of given up, many people have given up on their old lives, you know, on what has happened before. And they also realize that, like, they're going to, if they do reach safety in Europe, they're not really going to come across people who understand these experiences necessarily. And there was the first time that I started looking at relationships and love and marriage and all of that was in a detention center called Abu Salim. That was one where the guards who had been looking after it ran away, or they disappeared anyway during conflict. And the refugees and migrants were basically left to look after themselves. And I was really fascinated by this because they basically set up a committee to govern the detention center. They started imposing their own rules. They didn't want to, you know, they felt like this was still the safest place for them. So they chose not to leave because the rest of Libya was also very dangerous for them. And they ended up just staying in this detention center. But in a lot of the detention centers, men and women were kept in separate halls. They weren't allowed to mix together. And in this detention center, when the guards ran away, they all ended up mixing. And I spoke to people there who said, you know, everybody's falling in love, basically. Like, we haven't, you know, the men hadn't seen women, the women hadn't seen men in months or in some cases years, and suddenly they're all getting to intermingle. And some of them did end up like staying together, getting married. But in other cases, you do have marriages of convenience. And that's what I also looked at in Libya, because of the way that the evacuation program happens. So there is like a very small number of people who get evacuated through, you know, the UN. So it's kind of like a legal route to safety. And that also takes years, and it's not guaranteed at all. You know, it's kind of like it's your chances are still very tiny, but they're better if you're in a relationship or if you're married, basically. And so you would have some people who said that they were married to basically do favors to other people. Or, you know, there's one detention center, Tejoura, where I document that there were actually people getting married. You'd write a letter. So if you were in the men's cell, you might write a letter to the women's cell. And there were kind of detainees who worked with the guards. They were called capos. And you might give one of them a letter and ask them to take it to the women's cell and see if somebody in the women's cell would agree to marry you, basically, or to say that you were married. And so you might not even have met, but you'd end up being evacuated together. And some of those relationships did stay together. And then you also had a lot of people. I mean, there's more, obviously more detail in the book, so I'm probably not explaining it very well, but there were other people who had been in love with someone who had left them behind. You know, they were married or they were engaged, and they were pining the person they had left behind. And a lot of the time that would be men that had basically agreed or decided to go first so that they could then send through family reunification. Once they got to a safe country, they could try and make sure that the woman didn't have to go along this dangerous route, you know, which is kind of rife with violence, and you don't have a guarantee of surviving. And so they'd want to make sure that their partner didn't have to get exposed to that, or even partner and children. But they'd end up in the detention centers where they were considered as single men, so they didn't have the same likelihood of being evacuated, which I know is very hard for some people, that they actually had to consider, you know, will I enter into a fake marriage, or will I actually, you know, get married to someone, or will I stay true to the person who's behind me and potentially spend years in this one detention center?
Thank you for explaining that. I think it does really powerfully speak to the human aspect of this. And that is something that can get lost. So I'm glad it was in the book. And I wanted to pick up on something that you mentioned before, that sometimes it was easier to communicate when there was violence outside, because the militias were, in essence, distracted from oppressing the people in the detention centers. So we already talked about the context of a lot of this is the fact that Libya doesn't have a central organized government and hasn't for a while. But the civil war in Libya has kind of gone through ups and downs. And in 2019, restarted in a pretty high-level way, I guess, a quite intense way. So how did that impact the refugee centers and experiences in Libya?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to say that, and I honestly was new to, I hadn't reported on Libya really before. I mean, I had followed the news, but I wasn't aware so much that actually the fighting, like you said, it kind of ebbed and flowed. I wouldn't say that there was any period that was completely peaceful. And I knew that because, like I said, the refugees and migrants, they were all being held in militia bases. So you could tell when there was conflict, they'd end up being in the middle of it, basically. But yeah, that war, so it was Khalifa Haftar, the Eastern general, declared that he was going to try and take Tripoli with his Libyan National Army, the LNA, on the 4th of April 2019. And I remember it like very well, actually, because I started getting so many messages from people who were just terrified. And he, that war went on for, I mean, a long time, but that became, you know, it was very dangerous for refugees and migrants who were in detention for many reasons. One of the ones that became very obvious very quickly was that weapons were being stored in the detention centers, and that detainees were actually being forced, or, you know, they were being forced to move them around, or to even help militias, or even to go to militia bases, to go on the front line, to be assisting them. And that, I mean, yeah, that was like very dangerous. And also it pretty quickly became clear that at least in one or several detention centers, detainees were warning that they were being used as human shields. I mean, they warned this in several, but in one detention center, there was subsequently an airstrike, which killed more than 50 people. There was no registration that had been done. They were not named, and they were buried in unmarked graves. But they afterwards, you know, the UN-backed Tripoli-based government was saying, you know, this is a war crime that you've targeted innocent people that Haftar's side had. But at the same stage, it's also a war crime to use, you know, civilians as human shields. And that was the other allegation, that was also a war crime that was being carried out. So yeah, the refugees and migrants, like, they were right in the middle of it. They became, you know, used by everybody. And at the same stage, like you said, there was that kind of weird counterpoint where people did have more freedom in a certain sense. And I definitely noticed like the repression increased at times when there was more peace. Like there would be, you know, just games played with them, basically. There were things like, you know, the water would be turned off all day except for 10 minutes, or they'd be, you know, deliberately denied food, things like that. Whereas actually it became a bit easier for people sometimes during the war, if, you know, to move around a bit more. They could move out in the compound sometimes, or, they just weren't being observed so much. But yeah, it was complicated, and that was something that took me a while to realize as well, because obviously the war sounds more dramatic, and it was absolutely terrible, and people died in it, and, you know, they were abandoned, they were frightened all the time, they were hearing bombing, I was being sent audio recordings of people, you know, in absolute terror. But yeah, neither is a good situation to be in, is it? And then there was also another militia attack on another detention center called Kasr bin Gashir, where several people were killed as well. That was by the by people aligned with the LNA. And that the allegation there was that they were trying to move them. So it was a militia base as well. And you know, what the victims said was that that the management had been trying to move them out, but they were refusing to go because the management was trying to move them to a detention center that was like 180 kilometers outside of the city. And in that detention center, a person died an average of every fortnight from medical neglect and a lack of food. And so they didn't want to go there. They felt like they'd be forgotten there, that actually it was safer to be on the front line of a war rather than in a detention center where there was no aid and no foreign organizations and no assistance. And one of the allegations then was that that this militia attack had been a deliberate attempt basically to get them to leave so that it could be used as a military base.
So that brings up a really important point, because why would you want to stay? Why would you want to stay in one of these detention centers? But you detail throughout the book that there is an actor that we haven't really talked about yet that is also quite complicated, because there is, what you show in the book, quite a lot of discrepancy between sort of the stated aims and roles and actions of these actors and what seems to actually be happening. And that's the UNHCR and the IOM, so the UN Office in Charge of Refugees and the International Organization for Migration. What role do they play in these inhumane refugee detention centers?
Yeah, IOM and UNHCR, they're both UN agencies. UNHCR is the one that's mandated to protect the rights of refugees. So that's their role. And then IOM has different roles depending on the country. But in Libya, one of the things that they're doing, I mean, they visit detention centers, they do some medical aid and things like that. But they also oversee the it's called a like a voluntary repatriation program, but it's basically an EU-funded program that sends people often out of detention centers back to their home countries. So it's called voluntary, but I mean, that's very arguable, because if you're locked up in a detention center and you have no other way to get out, and you've been there for months or even years, and, you know, people are dying of tuberculosis and you're not being fed, like, then, you know, you might see this as your only option. So so I think by the time I started reporting on this, or I forget the exact figures, but it's around 50,000 people that had been returned, like tens of thousands of people anyway, have been returned to home countries through this EU-funded program. And then UNHCR as well, those two agencies are receiving a huge amount of EU funding. So, I mean, when I started reporting on this, one of the first things I did, I contacted a Libyan journalist to try and verify information. And then I started contacting NGOs, because I thought, you know, there must be NGOs or UN agencies who have access to these centers who can help people there. And quite quickly it emerged that they did sometimes have access, but that access wasn't guaranteed. And there were a lot of like conditions that had to be met, you know. UN agencies, for example, if they visited, they'd call ahead, they might not be given access anyway, they might not be allowed into certain parts of the center. It might be that people were hand-picked to come out and meet them, rather than that they could enter the halls and see everybody. So there were a lot of limitations, but the reason that they were particularly, or are particularly important, is because the EU, when you interview European politicians and you say, you know, basically your policies are responsible for returning tens of thousands of people to detention centers that have been compared to concentration camps, you know, and how could you do that? They will say that we don't approve of the detention centers and we do want them closed, but in the meantime, we're funding the UN to improve the conditions inside them. And so that's why the UN becomes very relevant there, because they are being, you know, they are being referred to by the European Union as kind of like, not a justification, but like a explanation or a, you know, an answer for what is happening. Mm-hmm. And so the UN, between UNHCR and IOM, they have many partner organizations. That's what they're called. They're kind of other NGOs that they give money then to. The only big NGO that I know of that operates in Libyan detention centers that doesn't take EU money is MSF, Doctors Without Borders. But the others, yeah, like they tend to be, like they're taking EU money. So I began to be contacted by staff that were working with UNHCR, with IOM, and with other agencies that basically said they're very uncomfortable about how they feel that they're being used, that they felt like they were being used to whitewash the brutal effects of EU policy, and that they can't speak out directly. You know, they might kind of like in a roundabout way criticize the conditions, but they wouldn't say this is happening as a direct result of European Union migration policy. And I know that a lot of staff working for them were kind of uncomfortable about that. And yeah, then there were allegations. I mean, it's written better in the book, of course, but there were allegations that they were misrepresenting the situation. And that was something, because I had direct contact with people inside the detention centers, you know, I would see the statement that was released by UNHCR, for example, saying that people had been moved maybe out of harm's way. But then I would be talking to those people and I would know from talking to them and from triangulating that information and from talking to, you know, anonymous aid workers and all of this, that actually they were in extreme danger, but the impression being given was that they, you know, that something good had been done, when actually that wasn't necessarily true. And so there's lots of examples of that in the book.
So I was wondering if you could maybe tell us about one of those examples. What was the GDF?
Yeah.
Why was it created? And then what happened?
So the GDF was the Gathering and Departure Facility. It was kind of built as an alternative to detention. And basically, when I started reporting on this for a long time afterwards, it was kind of said that this was going to be set up, that this was going to be, you know, not quite an answer to everything, but that it would be a good development and that the situation would get better. And it was meant to be, because UNHCR specifically was running or is running the evacuation program. So since 2017, I think around 7,000 people now have been evacuated from Libya. And these will be people who have, you know, generally what would be seen as legitimate refugee claims. You know, they're entitled to international protection if they can actually get to a country where they can claim that entitlement. And, you know, they can't go home. So they're pretty much stuck unless they can be evacuated through another means. And they, and this GDF was just set up basically to gather those people before they left. So they were just meant to go there before they were evacuating the country. And initially it was, I mean, it was delayed its opening. You know, by the time it opened, it became clear it's not, you know, an alternative to detention. It's just a place where people go before they are evacuated, which already they're like the very lucky people, you know, who have been chosen for that. And yeah, it was called the hotel because one guy told me it's the nicest place anyone has been in years. So they used to refer to it as the hotel. They were referring to UNHCR as the organization as well, which took me a while to cop onto. And it didn't last very long. So it ended up that there were disputes over the Libyan authorities, like what kind of control they had there. It became that there were also abuses happening inside the GDF. It had been built on militia land. It was being controlled. The outskirts were being controlled definitely by a militia. And actually, I interviewed people. It was across the road from another detention center called Trikalsika, and some of my sources in Trikalsika were brought to the GDF to basically perform slave labor under this militia. And there were other investigations done, like not by me, by Associated Press, that showed that, you know, the level of kind of corruption that was happening there, that money was being spent on these catering contracts that were going to Libyan militia leaders, or, you know, that there were so-called ghost employees, like people who were being paid who weren't showing up. And so it ended up shutting down. And part of the problem was actually that, so there were a series of catastrophes. One was that there was a detention center that I mentioned before called Tejura, where there was a airstrike, and at least 50 people were killed, potentially a lot more according to witnesses. But like I said, there wasn't any registration. It wasn't clear who had even been inside that hole. And the survivors ended up leaving that detention center and walking to the GDF and basically demanding to be let in, just saying that they needed safety, they needed protection. And they were allowed in, but yeah, I think that there were attempts then made to get them to leave again, which they were refusing to do. And then there was another group who left a detention center called Abu Salim. This was a few months later. And they also ended up marching to the GDF and also asking to be let in. Everybody wanted safety, you know. They weren't safe in the streets of Tripoli. They could be kidnapped. They could be taken by traffickers, by smugglers. You know, they were subject to all sorts of exploitation and abuse. So they just wanted to be in one location where they could feel safe. And the GDF then was shut down, and everybody was forced again out on the streets. And that was kind of the death of the so-called alternative to detention.
And just to clarify, because you do mention it in the book, and I think it is worth emphasizing, when you talk about people marching to the GDF or going from Tejura to the GDF, how far are we talking?
I think I'd need to check the exact distance, but I think they walked for hours.
They're not walking across the street, right? This is people choosing to walk long distances on foot in the middle of a war zone. Like, you don't do that on a whim.
But the other thing to remember is that some of those people actually hadn't been outside literally for years. Like, so that was one of the things that that really struck me that day. I mean, it was astounding to me that some of them were saying, you know, their eyes hurt, that they hadn't seen sunlight, that they couldn't actually look properly at where they were going. And people were weak, they hadn't been fed properly. Yeah, that was like a very brave, you know, a very brave effort. And the interesting thing was that they actually started getting support from the people they encountered. So they came across Libyans on the way who, even the police, they said they ran into some police who started giving some of them lifts, the weaker people, because they were saying, you know, we need to... I don't know. I think everyone was just so astounded at this kind of show of strength that they were thinking it's good to assist with this. So, yeah, that was pretty incredible.
So speaking of astounded, you talked a little bit about this before, but I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit more. What has your experience been like when you go to interview EU officials or UN officials or individual country politicians and sort of say, hey, this is what's happening. Are you aware of how bad it is? Kind of what's your response? What's happened when you've done that?
I mean, because I reported on this for years, there wasn't like one big interview that was, you know, that was the time that I did that. It was more that I had kind of pretty regular communication with a lot of people and a lot of officials. And definitely with the EU Commission, I was getting generally stock responses. You know, it wasn't like a speaking interview. It would be that I'd send them questions, or, you know, they didn't want to do a speaking interview because I attempted to get some. But others who interviewed them, I mean, there was, it's a mixture that sometimes people will admit the failures, or even a former EU migration minister, he said that, yeah, there is a contradiction in terms of the EU policy and in terms of the fact that, you know, that what people is being subjected to, basically, that it is problematic. So that it's not that they're not aware of this, but one thing that you generally get people saying, especially if they're speaking, you know, anonymously, if they're not actually making a statement, is that actually they have to get reelected and that the general public does not care about this or does not want this to change and is quite happy to hear the migrant crisis is over and that the numbers of people arriving in Europe are down. And we actually had that, like, in 2019, I put it in the book that the EU, I think it was 2 months before the European Parliament elections, they came out and said that the migrant crisis is over. And, you know, that obviously was, depending on how you define it, I guess, they saw what had happened as a success. But I interviewed UN officials, they will tell you that the situation is bad. It's not like no one is saying the situation is bad, but when it comes down to the semantics, or particularly who is responsible, there are things that they can and can't say, or can and, you know, or won't say. And the other one is, sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
No worries. I kind of want to follow up on something, again, you mentioned earlier in this vein, which is the idea of the refugees having legal rights or legal assistance. And you detail in the book that there are some people putting together legal challenges against the EU for these policies that have had these results. Can you tell us maybe a little bit more about sort of where that's at currently, and sort of whether you think that that's a viable, if that's going to work?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this was something, again, that I actually became aware of partially because I was being contacted by people who wanted evidence. And I, you know, speaking to lawyers, they say like change comes through the law. Like, you're not going to get change by publishing reports. You're going to get change through court cases. So this, yeah, it's something that I've followed, and I did do a chapter of the book on it, but there's lawyers all over Europe, to be honest, I think, who are looking at this on different levels. But in terms of challenging, I know that there's a challenge with the EU Auditors Court. There's another one. Maybe I need to look up the exact name of it.
No worries. I think people can look up the details in the book. But I'm wondering kind of what you think of, you know, do you think this will work? What's sort of your impression been of this type of challenge, I suppose.
I mean, I guess that's the thing, because I was trying to find, when I started reporting on this, I mean, I in that chapter, I start with the one that seemed to me to be most extreme, or, you know, when it happened, I was quite surprised that there was a submission to the International Criminal Court to have the EU investigated for crimes against humanity. And I interviewed the two lawyers who were involved in that. And it seems like that hasn't progressed really. But I know that now the ICC, the ICC are more focused on looking at specific Libyans who they can see as individuals who are responsible for different things. Yeah, I know, are continuing that. Like, I think 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, the prosecutor has came out and said that there is evidence that crimes against humanity and war crimes are being carried out against refugees and migrants in Libya. So I imagine that that will develop, but very slowly. And to be honest, maybe people reading the book, they can kind of see that I became a bit disenchanted in all of this, because, like I said, I was being contacted for evidence and then was realizing, you know, first of all, I had an ethical challenge for myself, because actually my role is publishing reports. It's not supplying evidence to lawyers, you know. And I also wonder, you know, was I supposed to be doing that, or am I supposed to be doing that? And so I saw my role as actually just publishing reports, but I was aware of these court cases, and I did talk to lawyers about them. And they tried like a few different tacks, like in terms of challenging the financial spending, because that's a big thing in the EU, that there needs to be, or there should be, transparency in terms of how money is being spent, and huge amounts of money are being spent in Libya. And also across, I mean, most of, or like a lot of Africa. I think the EU Trust Fund for Africa is billions of euros, and that's being spent across 26 countries, and it's designated as crisis funding, or at least it was, so there wasn't proper oversight of that. And then in terms of other court cases, the big challenge that I heard, or that I came up against, was that lawyers will say, there's two things. So if you bring a court case and it fails, that actually could have devastating impacts. So you really want to have the right challenge, the right court case, or be challenging the right specific part of the law. And the second thing is that by the time that situation is actually resolved, or that there is a verdict, it's highly likely that the EU, or, you know, this happens with other rich states too, that they will have found some other type of loophole. And so actually the European Union Coast Guard funding is said to have come about as a result of the Hershey decision, which was in 2012, which was what decided that Italian ships couldn't return refugees and migrants to Libya. So as a result of that decision, you know, they had to find a workaround basically. And now that's just a big concern, that there will be another workaround, that will keep happening. And so no matter what the decisions are, and I think the decisions that I detail in the book, I think they're all kind of stalled. I haven't seen much progression on them. But also I know that, you know, that even by the time those decisions do come around, potentially things will have moved on. And that's what I found quite difficult as well, reporting on this, because I had a lot of like questions for myself, you know, when I'm gathering this information, and who can I like, what should be done with it that is going to be helpful to people? And I had a lot of lawyers contacting me, you know, looking for witnesses or whatever. And of course I'll pass on that information to people if I think they might be interested. It's their decision whether they want to take part and stuff. But actually there were so many people in immediate danger, and if you have a legal case or a legal decision, that's going to take years. And the other big challenge was that they wanted witnesses who were already in safe countries, and those are generally the people who actually want to move on with their lives rather than, you know, keeping reliving this. And it's the people who are in Libya or in, you know, other dangerous countries who are the ones who could do with, you know, a legal decision that would help them, or that would get them some assistance. And they're the ones that lawyers are generally less willing to work with, because they see that as, you know, they can't protect them. And I know,
thank you for explaining that.
Another thing that I know this isn't your direct question, but another thing regarding legal challenges, which is detailed in the book, is that I actually attended the trials of two smugglers or traffickers, Kidani Zacharias Habtemariam and Tawel Di Gwotam, who's known as Waleed. And both of those were people who I had heard about quite a lot from refugees and migrants who had come particularly from East Africa or the Horn of Africa. And they were both men well known for like torturing and, sexual violence and extortion and all of this. And they would have warehouses where they kept around 1,000 people inside and were basically torturing people every day, trying to extract more money from them. And eventually between them, I think they were accused of moving tens of thousands of people towards Europe. And so I heard in 2020 that they were both apprehended in Ethiopia. That was early 2020. And that had actually happened due to the quick thinking of a victim who had gone back to Ethiopia and literally ran into one of them in the street, Kidani. And he had called the police and the police had arrested him. And so both these smugglers ended up in Ethiopian prison. And I went to Ethiopia. I got a journalism grant. I ended up being the only person not involved with the trial alongside a Ethiopian journalist who translated for me, who actually attended. So I was the only independent observer along with this Ethiopian journalist. And that really shocked me because a lot of the rhetoric that we hear is about tackling smugglers and, you know, tackling the business model of smuggling and, you know, making sure that they can't operate. And these were two of the men that I knew from my reporting were like some of the most notorious. And nobody was paying attention to these trials. And I contacted a lot of embassies. I think I contacted the International Criminal Court, or at least I discussed with the prosecutors in Ethiopia whether they had been in touch. And I spoke to other like NGOs, you know, the UN, asking why nobody else is observing these trials. And what ended up happening was Kidani, one of them, escaped. He seemingly bribed a police officer, or at least that's what the allegations say, but he got out anyway and has disappeared again. And that, you know, that was devastating because I watched the victims, you know, I watched the people who testified against him who were absolutely terrified and had to come face to face with him and say what they had done or say what he had done. And in the end, there was no justice for them at all.
Thank you for kind of explaining that. I think it's a good example of sort of what maybe some of the lawyers you mentioned being scared of, if a case goes wrong, it could be really disastrous. In some ways, that's actually a good kind of example of it, unfortunately.
So that's just to be clear, that wasn't a case going wrong because that was a case where there wasn't proper observation. I mean, what they were worried about with the case going wrong is actually if there was a legal decision made that legitimize something terrible. In that case, that Kidani was actually sentenced, but it was only after he had already escaped. But it wasn't, yeah, that wasn't a case going wrong. That was just a lack of, you know, a lack of attention or a lack of interest, I would say.
Fair enough.
And that showed to me, like, because a lot of, you know, a lot of what we see is kind of decriminalization or the, you know, policies that are aimed at punishing vulnerable people or punishing, you know, the victims rather than actually going after the perpetrators. And I know that, you know, all the people that I interviewed who had been smuggled by Kidani wanted him prosecuted. They wanted him to suffer for what he had done to them. But instead, they're the ones who end up suffering, you know. And in terms of, I guess that comes around to, sorry, maybe I'm not answering very clearly, but in terms of what we were saying about the prosecution of the EU or who should be responsible in the EU, that's one thing that I really, that really came across to me when I was interviewing lawyers, was that actually for both political and legal reasons, it would be very hard to prosecute European, you know, either politicians or civil servants who had been involved in this. It would be easier to go after specific Libyans, and for a variety of reasons. And, you know, also, of course, with a legal situation, you can't, you need to have individuals. You can't just kind of go after an entity or a system. But that means because the EU is so kind of bureaucratic and also quite opaque in terms of how decision making works, particularly if you're on the outside, that means that it can be very hard to ensure accountability. And I guess the book is the reason that I wrote the book was a quest for accountability in a way, or just, you know, making sure that if there are any efforts to have accountability, that this evidence is available. I don't personally know, you know, I'm not going to say who I think should be held accountable, but I do think that that there has been a noticeable lack of accountability for what has happened over these 5 years.
And so a lot of it is documented in the book, and I think that's a really nice kind of conclusion, a really clear idea of the purpose of the book, or one of the purposes of the book. But now it is published. So what are you working on next?
That's a good question. I don't know, to be honest. I'm still kind of publicizing the book. And then also I work, as like I said, as the Irish Times Africa correspondent. So I'm just doing a bit of general reporting, but I don't know. This is my first book. I haven't had this experience before, and particularly something that, you know, you need to keep reminding yourself how horrific it is, how consequential it is, in my opinion. And at the same stage, it's been very, very difficult to get anyone to care. And that's what I'm hearing again and again, even when I'm doing these interviews. And that's why I'm so grateful to you for your interest. You know, that the general public don't care. And I guess it's important to say this isn't just a story about Europe and Africa. Like, that's what I've documented. But the bigger picture is that the rich world is basically putting up its borders. Like, it's what we in the rich world are inflicting on people who, you know, just had the chance of being born outside that area. And also, like, how... like whether those efforts to try and stop people from moving, for example, are actually increasing oppression and increasing, you know, systems where people are suffering in other parts of the world. And I think that there's a lot more questions to be asked about that. I know in the US, you guys have your own related issues going on, and also in Australia, and, you know, definitely all around Europe. It's happening. And another thing to mention, sorry, is that this is actually a pivotal time. I didn't know this when the book got published, but the head of the EU border agency, Frontex, has just stood down. And that's partially because of allegations that the human rights of refugees aren't being respected by the agency. And we don't know, I don't think yet they've decided who will lead it. So this is, you know, kind of a, I don't know. It's a big question. It's a big challenge.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing your time and insights with us to discuss these big topics and challenges. And of course, thank you for documenting the evidence in the book, again, titled My Fourth Time We Drowned, published by Melville House Press in 2022. Listeners can go find it. It's out now. And obviously they can follow you in your writing on this and many other topics. So thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me again.